Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Good Wednesday afternoon. We are here to discuss a couple of things. We want to review the clinical trends, discuss through some of the clinical advances and research that has come out in the past month and really the past 2 months. And just discuss some insights that we have seen in some of the research around healthcare disparities. And following that, we'll go into open discussion. So I want to start by just really level setting and looking at the state of the state. This is from Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center. And as you all may be aware, we're at 16.7 million cases throughout the world. If you advance to the next slide, you'll see that for the US, we're really at 4.3 plus million cases, throughout our country. That brings our death total to over 149,000, which is really 23% of all the deaths we see globally. So, you know, we're still in the thick of it, as I think we all are aware. And if you are here sitting with me in Florida, you go to the next slide, you'll see that Florida has, over these past 4 weeks, had a dramatic shift in the numbers of positive cases. We're going to get into some of the trends that we're seeing here and positivity rates and those discussions. But, you know, just in looking back, when I look back through these journal clubs and seeing that number, how it has escalated since the end of June to now, you know, it really makes us have to take a pause and reflect on where we're at in this state. So you, as many of you are aware, we started doing testing and things in the state of Florida. And if you go to the next slide, I just wanted to share what we've seen since really initiating those tests. This graphic takes us back from June 29th through to July 28th. And we are seeing a positivity rate within our residents of 4.1 and amongst our staff of 3.36. You know, that brings us into the discussion of really looking at the clinical trends and updates. So if you go ahead and advance to the next slide, what I like to do is to really look at some of the updates that we've seen from the CDC and CMS. So in this first one, I'm not sure if anyone caught it, but this was really announced, this change was announced on the 22nd of July last week when we saw that the CDC really started to define a difference between mild to moderate and severe cases and how long isolation should be continued for those cases, really impacting a lot of what we're doing in some of our SNFs, where we have isolation units and as well as those dedicated COVID-19 units. So for mild to moderate, they're recommending that isolation and precautions be discontinued after 10 days after symptom onset, provided that the fever and all other symptoms are resolved. And then for those with more severe illness, they're recommending isolation and precautions for up to 20 days after symptom onset. When we look at why the CDC has made this recommendation, I wanted to highlight a paper that they used in their references. You can see if you go to their site, they're really looking at how in these patients who are more severely ill, how long can you detect viral shedding? And if you advance to the next slide for me, Shane. So this paper is a preprint, and it will be published in the British Medical Journal. And it looked at 129 patients with severe or critical COVID, and the duration of infectious virus shedding ranged from 0 to 20 days, with the probability of detecting infectious virus dropping below 5% by that 15th day. There's another article that they reference where they looked at five hemodialysis patients, and they saw that you could detect COVID for 24 to 37 days following symptoms. So there's still some variability, but this is really why the CDC took that stance and decided to make that recommendation change. If we go to the next slide, I want to talk about some of an update that we saw from CMS last week as well. And this was around funding and weekly data, assistance and supported testing strategy. So we're going to stay here for a minute. Funding, they've now devoted an additional $5 billion to Medicare certified long-term care facilities. And you may, if you're a part of FHCA or some other organization, you may have seen that announcement come out because there was a lot of excitement around the fact that there would be more dollars invested in our SNFs and ALs. Weekly data of high-risk homes will now be rolled into the weekly governor's report. So there's going to be in an effort to make everyone more aware, more transparency, that data is going to be rolled up into the governor's report that is delivered every week. And then there's also a task strike force that has been deployed to multiple facilities, 18 facilities across 6 states, Florida being one of them. Also saw that there was deployment in Illinois, Louisiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Texas. So across those six states, 18 nursing facilities had these task force come in and provide on-site technical assistance for education, telehealth, and other support that they may need. And then the final thing I want to talk about, the thing that caught a lot of our attention, is the testing strategy. So what CMS recommended is that for any facility who's in a state that has a 5% or higher positivity rate, that they need to test their staff on a weekly basis. So in Florida, as many of you are aware, we had the ruling that came out on, I believe, the 18th of June that said we needed to have all SNF and AL staff members tested every 2 weeks. But if your state, according to CMS now, is at a 5% or greater positivity rate, they're recommending weekly, it actually requiring, it's not a recommendation, requiring weekly testing. So if you advance, that gets us into a really interesting spot, because as you can see from this graphic, and if you're having trouble, we'll definitely make sure it's in the handout that we send out for this this session. 34 states have higher than recommended positivity. This was updated on the 27th of July. I checked it again this morning and it still remains the same. Florida, if you look, is all the way at the end of those orange bars, with only Arizona and Mississippi being higher. At this moment in time, Florida's positivity rate is ranging around 19%. So the World Health Organization is recommending that for any state with any state or country whose positivity rate is greater than 5%, they should not be open. Opening guidelines are really for the World Health Organization are for 5% or lower. And we'll talk about that in a few more moments. But I just want to just point out, you know, 34 states are higher than that recommended positivity. So in those 34 states, it is recommended that it is required that they have weekly testing for their SNFs and ALs. If you go to the next slide, This is a snapshot of Florida. And if you are on from another state, this is out of the Johns Hopkins Resource Center as well for COVID. And you could go and pull this data for any of your, for any state and as well as country. And this was dated on the 27th as well. So at that point, we saw that we had a decline in new cases, a decline in daily tests here in Florida, but the positivity rate remained elevated. You know, I looked again for this morning and we're still averaging out at 19%. If you go to the next slide, this really depicts where we are in comparison to some other countries. And I know there's been a lot of news about how much we're testing and the fact that we as a nation are doing a lot of tests. What the World Health Organization is stating that countries who have high positivity rate are probably only testing their sickest people. So, you know, what makes me feel better is that the United States is at 6.60% when we're looking at this positivity rate depiction. I think that the issue is that for most of our states, as previously shown, we are too high to have reopened, and we did reopen, and that may explain a lot of the surging numbers that we're seeing, as well as the fact that in some countries who have had lower testing rates per capita, they implemented social distancing and masking and other things a lot more effectively. So even though they may not be doing the same number of tests, their positivity rate is still lower because they have less disease prevalence. So I keep getting asked that question because it has hit the media so hard about, well, if we're doing more tests, is that the reason why we're finding more cases? The answer is no, it's really disease prevalence. So just in case any of your families or someone else, patients or anyone is asking that question, I think I was really surprised when I got it because I just thought that there was a different level of understanding. So the cases that we're seeing, the positivity rate, it means that we're still finding those we still have a high rate of infection in the community. You could go to the next slide for me. And this, you get multiple views of this. This is also out of Johns Hopkins, and it shows us where we sit, deaths per 100,000 individuals. You know, we're not the highest, which is good, even though we still, as I said, make up 23% of deaths globally. We are not as high as the United Kingdom, Peru, and Chile. So, you know, there is a lot of information coming out. This is one of those sites that you could get almost any question answered if you're looking for something regarding around testing, mortality, all that information. So I highly recommend utilizing that. In going forward, I want to touch upon some clinical advances and research. So if we go to the next slide, you know, there was some interesting articles around wastewater testing that I've seen in the media. Scientific articles, I haven't seen as much. But in a discussion I had with Andrea Moser, who is one of the leading long-term care physicians in Canada, who's very active with AMDA, she was stating that they've begun doing wastewater testing. And what that really means is that, you know, it speaks for itself. It's just a way to surveil the wastewater to see if there's any virus in those fecal samples. We have seen this done in a lot of other countries around the norovirus and other viruses. I will say that it is something that is being pushed heavily by certain countries. Australia has a very big collaborative and looking at their states and territories to begin ramping up this testing. In Finland, they're actively doing this. In the Netherlands, they're actively doing this. And Pakistan, they're doing this. And then when we're looking at what's happening in the United States, states such as Colorado, Ohio, and New York, those are the three that I've seen where they are really interested in doing this type of testing. The advantage that it presents is that when we look at a fecal sample, that fecal sample may become positive within 3 days of infection. And you may see a positive result 1 to 3 days before having any symptoms. So the logic is that we may be able to detect virus and detect where these hotspots are a week or two before there's an outbreak. So I think there are a lot of nursing facility chains who are interested in this. I don't know what it would take yet to operationalize this nationally, but there, you know, Colorado, as I said, they're really looking into this, and Ohio's EPA is looking at this very closely. So more to come on that as we start seeing some results. If you go to the next slide, I wanted to just call out this special report that was in the New England Journal of Medicine, and is the reason why. We can also advance the slide, is that this is a national call to action for scientists and organizations who may have any ideas around testing strategies and approaches that the NIH is rolling out. The goal is to identify and then accelerate the development of a testing strategy, scale it up and deploy innovation. So it's really exciting in that regards. And if you advance to the next slide for me, they're really asking for any innovations around testing strategies. So I think things like the wastewater surveillance, the fact that you can pick up so many, get a large idea of what is happening in that population for maybe a city, or if it's specific to the nursing facility, much faster than you could if you were trying to test everyone. If in order for us to do testing at the level that we would need to do testing, we're looking at billions upon billions of dollars. And I think that in the NIH's proposal, they're really trying to figure out, okay, what are the best ways? What are the strategies? So I don't know if anyone else has seen this article. It was really exciting to me because it's like they are looking for ideas. And I think we've had many discussions where we've talked about different things. I don't know if something's going to roll out through AMDA, but I would love to see us as a state organize and figure out what are the best things that we can, what are the innovative things that we could push for in doing and designing something like this. And that's just me on that soapbox, but we could keep going forward. Another thing that I wanted to just highlight, more so because it's in the media, a lot of the latest news stories, and we're not going to discuss what has happened in the media, but just to once again reiterate that there's yet another study that is now out that shows that we have not seen a benefit of adding hydroxychloroquine to the treatment. In this study, they looked at patients who had mild to moderate disease. They studied those patients and they either gave hydroxychloroquine alone or with azithromycin, and compared that to those individuals who received nothing, and none of those interventions over 15 days to see how was there any improvement in outcomes or anything, and they found nothing. And I think that is the takeaway message. A long way from where we were back in March and April in our understanding of this drug and what we're seeing. So I believe, once again, we're there. We haven't seen any reason to utilize this medication. And I just wanna make sure we're all aware of that literature. If we go to the next study that I wanna highlight, because this is dexamethasone in hospitalized patients, and this is a preliminary report. So I would really advise you to look out for it, because I know there's already editorials about the recovery collaborative group and this study. There's a lot of interest in this. The purpose of this study was to see how steroids may modulate the inflammation-mediated lung injury, and if it would reduce the progression of to respiratory failure or the progression of death. So if you go to the next slide for me, they looked at a really great sample size, over 6,000, and 2,014 patients were randomized to dexamethasone, and 4,321 received usual care. They found that with dexamethasone, there was a lower mortality rate over the 28 days in those who received dexamethasone with invasive mechanical ventilation or oxygen. The only time we did not see that that those findings were for that group who represented in panel D who did not receive oxygen. So it is really interesting. I think that, like I said, these are preliminary findings, so the study is still going on. And so we're really looking to get more information out of that. Another advancement, if you proceed to the next slide, and I know we're moving through these, I'm hoping we'll have time, a lot of time for discussion. We have, we're always looking around and looking for information about vaccines and where we're at. And this hit the media circus on July 14th when it was published, this preliminary report. It really is looking at the phase one of this vaccination study. So there are 45 adults who were included, age range 18 to 55, and they were randomized to three groups, 15 participants per group. And what they found is that each group received two doses, that after the first dose, there was antibodies created, and after second dose, even more antibodies created, and that the antibody response was induced in all participants at all doses of the vaccination. So very exciting that we saw that, but we then started seeing, as we should, the conversation around immunity resurface, and how long does immunity last, and should we really be thinking about that, and what do we need to think about in regards to how to create a vaccination? And one of the letters to the editor that I really appreciated, if you advance to the next slide, was in looking at the rapid decay of the antibodies in a person with mild COVID-19. And in this study, they looked at they had 34 participants, and they were analyzed and tested to see from day, the initial day to 18 days later to, I believe, 37 days later, what were their levels of antibodies. And it was really interesting. And this graphic demonstrates that we didn't see the uniformity. So there is no, this study doesn't suggest that we will definitely have a positive antibody response that lasts following exposure and illness to COVID-19. So it really makes us, I think, understand that we have a lot more research to go. I have people, and I know there are a lot of people who are very excited, like, oh, we're going to have a vaccine by the end of the year. But we really have to just be honest with our patients. And I think all of my family members is what I've stated, that there's a lot more research that we need to do in addressing a vaccination. So wanted to just bring that up. And if we move to the next slide, something that I think if you follow the NIH blogs, that was really exciting that came out yesterday was immune T cells and how they may offer lasting protection against COVID-19. And this really was addressing the fact that when we looked at SARS and MERS, we found that there was memory T cells that had stuck around for many years following the exposure for some of those patients who had that infection. So in the study that is being published in Nature, which if you advance to the next slide for me, this study they looked at 36 individuals who had recently recovered from COVID with mild to severe degrees of infection. And what they found is that all of those individuals had produced T cells that recognized multiple parts of COVID-19. So it is to be published. It has been accelerated. And I think there is the publication is out. So we'll make sure you get this article, which is still a preview, but it created a lot of excitement, I would say. And I think I've read a couple of articles in the media, not so much in journals like New England Journal of Medicine or JAMA, but they're out there where they're discussing T cell immunity. So, and the last thing that I wanted to cover with you, it's really some insights that we're gaining around healthcare disparities. And I'm going to start with a JAMA article that was recently out. It is assessment of community level disparities in coronavirus infections and deaths in large U.S. metropolitan areas. And this really looked at the rates of poverty and disease prevalence. So if you go to the next slide, just one of their tables that I want to highlight really is when we're looking and thinking about healthcare disparities, racial inequalities, and the impact that it is having on COVID-19 infections, is really interesting to see a breakdown like this where they were looking at county level poverty and income, race and ethnicity, and then looking at the amount of infection that they had in those counties. The first county that they highlighted were counties in Atlanta, and it really just goes through, it looks at that level of income and those things. And I think it showed what we would expect to see is that more the counties that had more poverty, the counties that were non-white had higher infection rates. Those rates were at times, in looking at this and what they compared, 8 times greater than the counties that were more affluent and had higher populations of white people. So it is an interesting study. There are so many now that are coming out of JAMA where we're seeing cases that in certain areas where higher percentages of one ethnic group is being affected over the white population in that area. One study from, I think that's coming out of Baltimore, showed that the people who were of Hispanic ethnicity had 40% higher rates of infection. So there are some interesting things. Could it bring everything? Because we would never get to a point where we could actually sit and talk. But just some things that we need to keep our eye on. And one that I did want to bring forth was a study that was published in the Journal of American Geriatric Society last month. And that is COVID-19 infectious and deaths among Connecticut nursing home residents. And looking at where the correlations are. Their hypothesis was around the nursing staffing and the quality ratings and those facilities who may have higher quality ratings and better nursing staffing models would fare better in their infection rates and in the mortality rates versus those facilities who did not. And they also looked at those facilities that may have higher numbers of Medicaid residents, as well as higher ethnicity groups. So in looking at that, they did find that the facility who had a better RN staffing and higher quality ratings had better control and a better handle on COVID-19 infections. They also found that those facilities who were suffering or not doing as well had higher numbers of racial and ethnic minorities in their populations and were predominantly Medicaid facilities. So I don't think it surprises anyone. I think that it may make us think about how we need to ask the next question and where we need to think about in just talking about disparities for a moment, if you have asked the next slide for me, what we see is, you know, when we're thinking about healthcare disparities, that is just one piece of that puzzle that goes into making a health outcome, you know, seeing health outcomes. So behavior, clinical care, policy, all of it is important. And there was a slide depicted by the New England Journal of Medicine that I wanted to share with you, if you advance to the next slide. Because when you, I think what the challenge is that when you think of the social determinants of health, you really have to look at it a little bit broadly because it's impacting every piece of the puzzle. So I challenged myself to just look through some of the data that we are getting out of Florida and look by zip codes, and you can almost predict which facilities are going to have the higher number of residents being transferred out, and unfortunately just by zip code. And it is something that I think has been highlighted in the news media, but it continues to, we continue to need to have that discussion amongst ourselves about how are we looking at this and the impact of social determinants of health on our nursing facilities in our communities. And I think to end with, just to give us a bigger, broader view, I wanted to highlight this paper that was in the New England Journal of Medicine as well. It is looking at the implications for the healthcare system. And if you haven't had a chance to read it, just as every article that we rolled through will be put on in our library, this one definitely will be, because this article really addresses the fact that every part of healthcare has been touched, as we are aware, but it actually discusses the impact to the provider and the fact that there has been a loss of revenue, changes in practice habits had to happen because of the way we are, that we need to protect ourselves, and you know, just the whole process of donning and doffing on PPE. I don't know how long what impact that is having on the day when you're rounding in a facility, but that and the impact to the outpatient settings, as many providers are independent, you know, what is that having on their revenue? It also addresses disparities. It addresses insurance and the way we are covering people. It looks at things from a really, I feel, a 360 degree view, and really brings to light some of the challenges that we're going to have to face and address as we try to rebuild while we're currently still in the midst of this pandemic. And with that, I'm going to bring it to open discussion, because I know we have some questions already in chats. So I want to make sure we address any other thoughts and questions.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
Okay. Yeah, we do have a question in the chat too. I was just going to let you know, from Dr. Diaz, are there any standard COVID protocols in the works for nursing homes, specifically clinical protocols?
I think we have, I know we've been working on something within FAMDA. There are some publications that have gone out through JAMDA where we had treatment recommendations and recommendations from the state of New York. There are some things that we were working on for this the CDC as well. Many people for FAMDA and AMDA were jointly working on those protocols. The challenge is that there has been a lot of movement. So if we're asking about basic best care recommendations, I think those things can be provided. It is really challenging though when a lot of the information is being updated so much more quickly than we can write. I don't know if anyone else has any recommendations or discussions. Yes.
I've read the new CDC guidance twice on transfer of patients, and I'm still not exactly sure. The new guidance, it seems to focus on people who have had a positive viral test or COVID-19 disease, and not on people who have been negative.
Yes.
Is that your interpretation? I mean, I still think people who have been negative should have two negative tests within, you know, that, as it has been before, two negative tests within 24 hours apart, within 48 hours of being transferred. But I'm getting like mixed messages about that. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's really the CDC's, the language that they used is really about people who had been, who had tested positive. I think there is room for interpretation for those who had not. I'm a little worried about what would happen because we've been going under the assumption for those who are in isolation who may have not yet been tested that somewhere between 10 to 14 days they can come out. And so I'll do some more research to see if there's anything else, but from everything that I've looked at, my interpretation is the same as yours. We do have another question.
Diane, could I just say one other thing about that? If you look on the CDC website, there's some, and go a little deeper, there's some very good explanation of why they changed it and and the rationale based on the duration of shedding replication competent virus. So I think that is sound, but for people who haven't had the virus or the disease, I don't think that's the right approach.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend going to their site and looking at their references. A lot of those articles are in either preprint or have not yet made it to the publication, but they were able to gather a lot of data from different countries and really looking at, okay, what are we doing? The hemodialysis article I mentioned is out of Japan. They looked at 5 hemodialysis patients, but there are some other articles where they looked at hundreds of people. And I think they made a really good recommendation. And when they changed it, I think that we just have to be mindful because we know that the limitations that we may have had at certain facilities across the country, some places where we're not able to still get testing in those facilities the way we would like, we need to work with our facility staff, the director of nursing, the administrator, to figure out a plan that is more suitable for those who have not been tested. I wouldn't want somebody to be isolated for 20 days suspecting that they may have an issue. I don't think that's the right interpretation. Any other thoughts, Dr. Auslander?
No. Thanks.
So I believe we had a question from Jack Katar. I don't know if I'm saying your name correctly, but the group sample testing in the United States, like some other countries are doing, are we doing any group sample testing? I do not know of that. I don't know if anyone else is on the call. And I'm assuming you're meaning like the pooling testing where we are pooling a sample and testing to see if they come out positive. If not, you can please do clarify.
Sandra, yes, that is correct. Where they pull the sampling from several individuals, that is correct.
Yeah. I've read about it, but I haven't seen it as as something that we're actively doing anywhere. So if there are any organizations or anyone representing maybe a nursing home chain where they're doing that, or an area on in the country where they're doing that, please speak up. Yeah, I know it is something that the NIH is interested in doing, and they put that in their paper that they published through the New England Journal of Medicine and in their blog, that they're really interested in understanding and figuring out a way to do the pooling of the population. I think it will be cost saving as well as beneficial to figure out where to deploy resources. So I know there's a lot of interest. So Dr. Edwards typed in the chat that if we all share our protocols, we can have a team look them over and make a unifying protocol. I think that would be beneficial. We, as I stated earlier, we have to be mindful of all the changes and the updates. I think if we want to do something like that, we could do it. We could take the approach that maybe the New York authors of that paper did. I think it would be great. All right, everyone. I thank you for joining.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.